Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Dung Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
I am Jorn. And joining us this evening is
Michael Jan Friedman,
the author of Kalis, which is the book we're talking about today.
Yes, we are going to talk about Kalis today. Published in July 1996, and it's an interesting book from an angle that I really thought was kind of neat. Didn't you, John?
Yes, which is an interesting concept. Mike, how did you dream up the idea of changing the myth of Kalis to almost a more realistic portrayal of the events?
Well, you know, I was looking for a sort of tension between the way that the mythical Kalis was understood and the way it really happened. I'm not sure where the idea came from, but I wanted attention. And the, you know, the proposal had pretty much everything I thought was going to go into the book. It wasn't until later in the book that I realized there was an opportunity there, which I won't specifically mention, to diverge from the outline and actually come up with something that cast everything in a different light.
Yet you were able to stick close enough to the known mythos of Kalis that all your real events fit right into his mythos.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's important. You know, one of the things I always like to do when writing Star Trek books was shed light on dark corners, places where, you know, we knew something but not enough. And this was another example of that. It doesn't carry the same weight unless you stick as closely as you can to what's known.
Was it your intention? My impression of the book, the way I read it was Kalis was just a normal Klingon who did not agree with the way things were being done at the time, and he became more of an unlikely hero rather than was actually seeking power. And so over the years, of course, as time went on and stories got retold, he became this super Klingon mythical legend that was given credit for doing things that he, or in a way that he didn't actually do them.
Right. I would say that's a fair appraisal. You know, I think it's true of a lot of cultural icons. They become bigger than life after a while. And of course, we know that at one time, you know, they had to take out the garbage, you know, and do all those mundane things that normal people do. In retrospect, we look back at them and we say, wow, that was incredible. But of course, at the time, they were living day-to-day lives and probably didn't have that perspective. Probably didn't know, you know, I mean, did Michelangelo know he would be renowned the world over? You know, he was famous in little milieu, but did he think he would be renowned that way? Or Shakespeare, did he think, you know, his writing would last 500 years? Or did he just think it would be, you know, it would be nice if he was known all over England? So, you know, the idea of someone becoming bigger than life. You know, that rang true, and that was something I wanted to book.
Well, that was great. I really enjoyed that aspect of the story. John, you have another question?
We touched on you're doing a more realistic treatment. Where did the idea come from to do a more realistic treatment?
Yeah, I think it was just, you know, my natural inclination is to take you know, big events and big personalities and kind of break them down into what they might have actually been. You know, as I say, with Shakespeare, with Michelangelo, you know, a lot of cultural icons, probably all of them, never thought that they would be as far and wide or for as long as they've become known. So Kalas would be in the same boat. He'd be doing what he did day to day, and probably not thinking too much beyond that.
As you were discussing that earlier, the Alfred Hitchcock movies came into my mind because he did something similar in taking the average man and throwing him into circumstances that were much beyond what he normally has to deal with, which is what you did with Kalas. Yes, he was a warlord. Yes, he was working for Molar, but circumstances thrust him into being something much greater, like most of the Hitchcock heroes became.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, we become larger than life when we meet the challenges of events and circumstances that are larger than life. You know, I think, yeah, Hitchcock, I think would probably be portraying people like that. You know, I think, for instance, in The Birds, you know, that was something that was happening. It was something extraordinary. And the people who were confronted by it and overcoming it to some extent were average people. You know, let's face it, there are very, very few people in history who had the opportunity to be known just because they were elevated by birth or by circumstance. It's usually the people who met circumstances that, you know, grand circumstances. Horatio at the bridge, you know, did Horatio have any idea that he was going to be celebrated almost 2,000 years later? He was just doing his job defending that bridge.
There are very few people throughout history who, like George Patton, spent his whole life training for a role that he gets thrust into. It's just circumstances that kind of make the hero here.
Yeah. It really is. You know, you probably don't think of yourself as a hero while it's happening. It's only afterwards that other people hang that label on you.
Yeah. So far we've talked about half of the story, the historic Kalas during the heroic times, where all the stories that we heard on Next Generation and have been fleshed out in many books are that. But you put next to that another story set in, quote, the modern era, and you included members of the Enterprise crew in there who were looking to solve a conspiracy. And we get these scrolls that are discounting Kalas and everything that he supposedly did. You want to talk right about that for a minute?
Yeah. You know, had I just written a book about the historical Kalas, I don't know if it would have been as accessible to readers. You know, the people that they were, you know, the characters they were used to following were the ones they saw on television. So that, I thought, for the book to be successful creatively and also commercially, I think it had to feature those characters. And then for those who maybe didn't care quite so much about Klingon tradition, or those who just couldn't hook into it directly, they had that bridge. They had, you know, oh, there's Picard, I know him. There's a Worf, I know him. Now I see how it all kind of fits together and how it becomes relevant and important. So, you know, I think you needed that intermediary step for people to hook into the Klingon history.
So on a technical note, did you write the two stories together, or did you write the two stories separate and integrate them together?
Well, a little bit of both. I didn't write either one in its entirety before I wrote the other one. I probably wrote 2-3 chapters of each, but it was important to coordinate them to get the most tension out of and irony out of the book. So you know, I might have a chapter that ends with a particular conclusion, and then go to the historical Kales, and you find that no, that's not exactly the way it happened at all. So I bounced back and forth, but I probably wrote 2-3 chapters at a time in either time period.
Mm-hmm. So during the story, we get Moroth, we get Molar, and we get a character that was just kind of floored me. I was looking for Lucara, and we got a different love interest for Kales. I'm wondering how that came about.
Well, you know, I forget if that character had been introduced on television at the time I wrote the book. Because it was written in 96. I think what I had in mind back then was I needed some freedom to do certain things with the character. And so I had to create that character in order to do those things, in order to have an arc that I wasn't painting myself into a corner. You know, I wrote the Stargazer series. And in doing that, I had a lot of characters that fans were introduced to. Some of them were introduced to fans in the book Reunion. Others had not. So I had that freedom. I couldn't do just anything I wanted with the characters that fans already knew the outcome of. But I had freedom with those other characters to do anything I wanted. I think that's the same idea that I had with Kales. I could draw on ironies that with established characters, but also have some other characters, so the reader didn't know how their arcs would end.
Ah, so that explains a great deal. So leading to the next question that John has written down here for us. If you had used the wrong name after it was used in the television series, if you had instead, they probably would have contacted you and said, wait a minute, the Kales' love interest is Lucara, not this other person that you created. And you would have had to probably have changed it.
It depends on the timing. It's possible that they would have said, no, you have to change it. Or, you know, it's... It depends on the timing. You know, I did when I was writing the Next Generation comic, I did a 4-issue miniseries called Shadowheart, and it was about Worf and his human brother. At the time I proposed it, they had no intentions of continuing showing Worf's human brother. We knew there was one, mm-hmm. but we didn't. Name and we didn't know anything more about him, and it was the last season, and I said let me propose this. They approved it, and then as I'm scripting it. And in fact, it had already been, I think, one or two issues had already been penciled. And they said, hey, guess what? We're coming up with an episode that shows Worf's human brother. And I had to change not only the name, but a lot of the circumstances in the comic, even though it had already been, all four issues had been scripted and they were drawing it already. I had to make changes on the fly. So it did happen sometimes that I would have to accommodate what was happening on the show and make changes.
Wow.
in this case, I didn't have to. Changing her name would have been a whole lot of trouble. But yeah, there were, you know, but that was rare. Usually I would propose something either for a book or a comic, and they would say, we're doing it, or you can't do that because it conflicts with something we're doing, or occasionally we let you do that and we can't tell you why.
Okay.
But I always managed to get enough through that that was approved for me not to have to bat 1,000.
So can we credit you with the creation of Nikolai in that case?
No. No. I mean, they created him on television. I just had to adapt to his existence and the story that they came up with for him. It wasn't easy. I mean, that was a particularly difficult one. They came up with the name and the character.
Okay.
That actually begs into the question of how much of a hand did CBS have in what you could do and what you couldn't do, and were they looking over your shoulder for most of the writing process?
Well, you know, first of all, at the time it was Paramount. And yes, he kind of looked over your shoulder, yeah. I mean, there were a few steps, and initially, it wasn't just their licensing department that had to approve everything, and also, of course, your editor at the publishing company. But there was a third step in that when Gene was alive, Gene Roddenberry, when he was alive, he had an office as well, and everything had to go through his office. So it went through his office, then it went through licensing, and then it also went through the editor. So it was, there were lots of layers of approval, but, you know, you deal with it. If you had, you know, if I had been a writer on a staff writer on one of the shows, I would have had, in a way, I would have had the same hurdles to go through. But they approved the outline. And once they approve the outline, they're generally pretty committed to that. And then you go write, and then you come back, and they, again, all the levels have to approve the manuscript again after that. So, yeah, they kind of, you know, I wouldn't say they were intrusive, but they definitely were looking over your shoulder. I mean, there's a, the licensing department was great. They knew what they were doing, and they looked at things from the writer's point of view because they had some creative sensibilities as well. Paula Bach was a big factor there in the Paramount's licensing department. But Gene's office, less so, because Gene wasn't so involved, and he had other employees who were, and I don't think they had the writer's perspective in mind. I'll give you an example. In the very first book I wrote, which was called Double Double, I got notes back from Gene's office, and there was a little of this and a little of that. And then it said, you have to take Chekhov out of the book. So this is in the days of these mammoth dinosaur faxes, these things that looked like atomic bombs, and took about 7 minutes to send the fax, and they would only respond once a day. So they said, you know, take out Chekhov. We said, why? Next day, because he wasn't on the ship at that time. We respond, how do you know? The next day we get another fax. Look at your star date. So there was actually a memo in the office at pocketbooks, there was a memo from Gene, and it said, ignore the star dates. I made them up as I went along. Don't worry about them. But here they were holding
us accountable. Especially considering the fact, here Chekhov knew Khan in The Wrath of Khan, and Khan was first season, and Chekhov was on the Enterprise till second season.
Yeah. So I said, let me get this straight in the next facts. I said, we can change 12 pages of dialogue, or we can change the star date. And the next day we got a fax back and forth, just one word, yes. So we ended up changing one numeral, and thereby we're able to keep Chekhov in the book. So that's what I mean. You know, had that come from the licensing department, they would have said, yeah, there's this problem, just change a numeral, okay? But Gene's office was not that fast on its feet. So that was typical of the kind of thing that went on.
Well, since we're talking about plotting and approvals and all this stuff, I want to throw a speculative question at you. Mm-hmm. The dagger that the clerics use to clone Kalis, apparently, in my reading of your work, is the dagger that Moroth is instead stabbed with. So did the clerics use Moroth's blood, and the Kalis clone is actually a clone of Moroth? And how would this affect things?
Well, you know, you remember at the very beginning, I said there was something that while I was writing the book, I said, hey, wait a second. Wouldn't it be cool if, and I diverged from the outline? That was where I diverged. So I looked at that and I said, hey, wait a second. Maybe it wasn't Kalis's blood. And so that, as you can see, that changes everything.
Yes, it does.
So there you go.
I finished reading this last night, and I read that part of the book, and it was like, what? You gotta be kidding me. We got Moroth's clone, who is posing as Kalis with Kalis's memories. And then, you know, after I thought about it for a while, if you took Kalis and Moroth and put the best of those two together, you would have a super character bigger than life.
Well, but it was really not Kalis. It was really not Kalis. The Kalis that we came to know in the modern era, what I call the modern era, was actually not Kalis at all. So that was something that was not in the outline, something that only occurred to me later on. And people have come up to me and said, I can't believe you did that. That's incredible. Turned everything on its ear. And it was only something that occurred to me at the very last moment. And then I had to have that approved. I had to have that approved separately before I could go ahead with that. But they were, you know, they were okay with it at Paramount. Douglas Adams, the guy who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, said once that a writer's only job is to surprise himself. And sure enough, in that case, I did surprise myself, and it worked out well. There are one way to look at writing. There are two kinds of writers. There are plotters, that's with a T, and pantsers. So people who plot and people who have a detailed outline to follow. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who go by the seat of their pants, where it goes.
Yeah.
So even though I plot, and I plot extensively and in detail. And because I want to make sure that where I'm going is a place I can get to. But at the same time, I leave a little room open for that little bit of inspiration to change what I'm writing, if it makes sense. You still have to reserve a little bit of pantser.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, though, Mike, I think you left clues earlier in the book that this was going to happen, because Morath was coming up with all of the lore or teachings that Kalis is going to be responsible for as you go along. So you may have thought about this as a point before you thought about it as a point.
Yeah, that's true. Some of that led me to believe, you know, sometimes there's a, you think you're doing the writing and your characters are actually writing the story. I think in that case, I started to see Morath was kind of writing this. And so I, you know, the worst thing you can do is try to shut up your characters. If they want to do something, they generally get to do something. But part of it was also going back and seeding, reinforcing that, so that when you got the revelation, it made sense.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, because a lot of the writer's block that I run into when I'm writing is I've written myself down a path that the characters or the storyline or something doesn't like. I got to back up, start over, and get it right.
Part of that could also be that you need to plot more. If you don't at least know the ending, now you can always change it, but if you don't have a satisfying ending in mind, then it's sort of an exercise in futility. You need to know where you're going, and then when you get there, you might say, gee, this is not really where I want to be. And then you go back, maybe you could change the ending, or you could go back and change the beginning. Because the ending and the beginning have to work together. But I think for people who are just starting out or are early in the process of developing their writing ability, is very. I don't know if that's what you want to hear, but I would say it's very valuable.
Well, oh yeah,
yeah.
Without an ending, you don't know where you're going.
Right, right. You know, I mean, if you were setting out on a trip, you really should know where you're going in most cases, right? I mean, you know, sometimes you just want to wander, but in most cases, you want to know what your destination is. And you might change it. You might say, I don't really want to go to London. I really want to go to Paris. But you should have something in mind when you hit the airport.
Yeah, probably before that, TSA would tend to frown on that.
Right. Right.
And one of the things that I really appreciate you for, Mike, your writing, is your ability to put a twist in your plot. And I'm almost embarrassed to say I'm forgetting one of your recent releases. Every story, you know, at the end just kind of goes, it goes wonky on you. And it's like you can't help but laugh because you were led down the garden path so easily, and there's a whole different deal going there. And that was an awesome book, by the way. Which one? Do you remember which one?
Was it Headless?
Headless. That's the one. Right. Yes.
Oh. you know, I grew up with the Twilight Zone, and so I can't resist in a lot of cases having an ending that twists. But actually, there are more recent inspirations for that. You know, if you look at The Usual Suspects, for instance, you know, mm-hmm. you think you're following a particular story, and then you get to the end and you realize, oh, that wasn't the story at all. Now I get it. Now I understand what came before. So I try to do that in my writing. The thing is, you can't just do that. You also have to, you know, have appealing characters and all that other good stuff. But whenever I can twist the ending a little bit, I think it's a valuable and very satisfying thing to do. I kind of see, you know, Rod Serling standing there nodding approvingly.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, you got me. It was neat. So let's talk about your history a little bit. How did you come to Star Trek as a fan? And then how did you come to Star Trek as an author?
Right. Well, As a fan, you know, I think I was 11 years old when Star Trek was first hit the airwaves, and it was you know, I've said this on other occasions. There's a line in The Great Gatsby, a phrase that's used for the first Dutch sailor that sees Long Island after that long voyage across the ocean. And it's an object commensurate to his capacity for wonder. It was the most he could possibly wonder. And when I saw Star Trek at that young age, it was the most I could possibly wonder. It was exactly the thing that I'd been looking for and didn't know I was looking for. It was exactly the proportions of action and meaning and color and futuristic thought and design that it was exactly what I wanted and had seldom even gotten a whiff of up until that point. So it was amazing. And I saw every episode week after week. But then I never saw them again, you know, until I became a professional and had to view them in terms of story research, because and it's true of almost everything I've seen. I very seldom see something a second time. I look at it, I look forward to it, I watch it, I enjoy the hell out of it, and then I'm done with it. I, you know, got that, I'm moving on. So that's what it was like. And in college, you know, I had friends who were into Star Trek. And I'd, you know, walk into the dorm room and they'd have the TV on and there'd be a Star Trek episode. And I'd watch for a little while and you know, and then I'd leave because I already saw that. I was writing books for Warner. Warner had a Star science fiction and fantasy imprint. And I wrote 4 books for them. And then they basically showed me the door. They said, "Hey, great. These are great. Thank you very much." None of them became bestsellers. "We'll see you." And I was like, "Huh?" And but that's okay. That was typical of publishing, even more so now than then. And my agent called right about that time and said, "Hey, you know, the Star Trek publishing program is going to expand. They're only putting out 6 books a year now, but they want to expand. And are you interested in that sort of thing?" And I was like, "Wow, are you kidding me?" Because I'd read books by Ann Crispin and Howie Weinstein. I'd read Star Trek books, and I thought they were amazing and compelling. And I loved the idea of putting words in the mouths of Kirk and Spock and McCoy. So I said, "Sure, absolutely." I wrote up a little proposal. My agent sent it to Dave Stern, who was the head of the program at the time, the editor. And when I spoke to him, he said, "Mike," he goes, "Mike, this is exactly what we're not looking for." What? Because, you know, I had written, he had read my first 4 books, which were all heroic fantasies. And he had said, "Yeah, I really like this guy's writing," but he didn't really want me to write a fantasy about Star Trek. So I had written something that went into Scottish mythology and you know, focused on Scotty. And he said, "No, we're not looking for fantasy, Mike. We're looking for Star Trek style science fiction." So I wrote him another proposal, and he looked at it and he said, "Mike, this is what we're looking for, but you didn't write an ending." And I said, "Yeah, I didn't want to spoil it for you." He goes, no, I'm the editor. I'm a pro. You can share the ending with me." So I did. And then he said, "Oh yeah. Great. This is terrific." And then he published that book, and that was my first Star Trek book. It was entitled Double Double. And it drew on the episode What a Little Girl's Made Of. It's about an android version of Kirk, and it little by little insinuates itself into the Enterprise and takes over and becomes Kirk, essentially, while Kirk is off somewhere else in a place he'd rather not be. really the first time that I shed light on a dark corner. You know, what happened to the android manufacturing mechanism on that planet after the adventure was over. So you know, first time that I really shed light in a dark corner, and you know, I did a lot of that. And I wrote about 35 Star Trek books, something like that. In many of those cases, that's what I was doing. So that's how I started writing Star Trek books. And then shortly after that, Next Generation came out, and Dave said, so what do you want to do now? And I said, you know, I'd like to write a Next Generation book, because that's the new series. That would be great. And became a book called A Call to Darkness, with the Next Generation cast, including not Crusher but Pulaski, because she was the doctor in residence at the time.
Ah,
yeah. So, and there in that book, what I wanted to do is take the characters out of their organization, the organization that exists on the ship, erase their memories, put them in a dangerous situation, and have them not know each other and still have to work together in order to get anywhere. Imagine them not being in Starfleet, imagine them meeting each other for the first time and still having certain relationships and some new configurations that who knows might have taken place if they hadn't met as part of Starfleet.
Huh. That's one we need to look at.
Yep. Yeah. It's it was fun. It was a lot of fun. You know, part of it is you have to have fun. You have to you know, if you're not having fun, that comes across. Mm-hmm. So as a writer, you want to have fun in whatever you do. There's got to be something in it for you.
So did you go to college with the intention of becoming a writer and take courses for that? Or?
Well, you know, I did. But at the same time, I never thought I'd be one. I mean, I pursued that to an extent. In college, I took writing courses with a guy named Jerry Mangione, who had won a National Book Award, and he was always, you know, he would always say, why do you want to write about these kind of mythical things and these science fictional things? Is that, you know, is there really a market for that? I said, I read them, but and he liked my work. And he actually turned me on to an editor in New York, his editor, who really, you know, couldn't do anything for me, but it was nice of him to make. But I didn't really think I was going to be a writer. I just wanted to pursue it as far as I could. It wasn't until, I think, in my junior year, Gizmo came to speak at the school. And I knew who he was. And he said something that I didn't know. He said he was a full-time writer. And I went, that's incredible. He's a full-time writer. Wow. Wow. If only I could do that. And but still, I didn't think I'd ever actually do it. But it was good to meet him and to get that somewhere on earth there was a full-time writer. Because I was under the impression that writers did it in their spare time or something along those lines. You know, where I grew up in Queens in New York City, I didn't know any writers. I didn't know anyone who knew any writers. It turns out that there were, like, you know, comic book editors and Science Fiction Digest editors that lived not too far from me, but I didn't know them and I didn't know of them. So to me, it was a very foreign kind of opportunity. And you know, in college, I would tell people, girls mostly, because it was a good thing to tell them, that I would die happy if I could just write one novel. If I could write one, just one, I would make that deal in a heartbeat. and it got me some dates, but you know, even then, it was just a fantasy. It was just something that I thought, you know, was just beyond the realm of possibility.
And here you are, 60 books?
Oh, it was 78.
78 books and counting.
I know. It's crazy. And you know, I am, you know, humbled and grateful that happened. It's because I'm well aware of the fact that there are many talented people who don't get that opportunity and deserve it perhaps more than I do. So I am, as I say, eternally grateful and humbled, and I feel very, very, very lucky.
Hey, you just keep writing. I'll keep throwing money at you. I'll tell you what.
It's a deal. You know, I find, you know, these days, you know, as you know, I do Kickstarters and I publish independently with Crazy 8 Press, which is a group that I co-founded almost 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we have an inventory of almost 50 books right now by me and by the other writers, all of whom are terrific. My numbers are, you know, the number of readers I have is less than when I was in traditional publishing all the time. But I find that they're more dedicated and better readers, you know, more intelligent and perceptive readers in general. And so I'm having a great time. And also, when you publish independently, the economics are such that you don't need 100,000. You don't need to sell 100,000 books to make it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Great. John, do you have anything else?
Question about the future. Have they talked to you about possibly working in the Discovery, Picard, or some of these other CBS All Access series?
No, they haven't. They haven't, and I haven't really pushed it. Listen, if they called, you know, I'd be very happy to answer the phone, but no, they haven't. You have to really, really work at it to get even the possibility of a nod there. And a couple of Star Trek writers have become staff writers or consultants there, but you know, there's a lot for me to pursue in life. And I don't think I could or would want to dedicate myself to that kind of push. Again, you know, if somebody calls, I mean, I probably know as much about Picard and have written as much about Picard as anyone on Earth. So if they did call, I'd be thrilled to speak to them. But I'm not going to put on that kind of campaign to try to get that gig.
So you're pretty much working in your own universes then these days, is that correct?
Occasionally I'll do something in some established universe. Not too long ago, I worked with a couple of my friends, Peter David and Bob Greenberger. We came up with the Bible for a Will Smith project that turned into the movie After Earth. And so we came up with a Bible that was as big as a book, and they were so bowled over that they decided to, you know, pretty much make us their publishing program. So we did write a couple books for them and some short stories as well. And so, you know, my guess is I'll be doing some stuff for traditional publishers as well. Whether or not it's Star Trek, you know, remains to be seen. I did write a graphic novel called Empty Space with Jim. I believe you've read that. Mm-hmm. And it's a graphic novel that draws, you know, to a large extent on my Star Trek experience, and with some twists and turns here and there. And I scratched that Star Trek itch with that. So, and also with a couple of short stories, Headless was one of them. So, you know, I do occasionally get the urge to write something Star Trek, either Star Trek or something Star Trek-like, but I have that opportunity to do it. And as much as I enjoyed writing Star Trek stories, there's something to be said for writing stories in your own universes and stories that are unfettered by editorial exigencies. Mm-hmm. And it's something, you know, really, really satisfying. So that's what I'm doing right now. But, you know, you never know what opportunities are going to come along.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you next, is which do you prefer? Your own universe where you've got more creative control, or a shared universe where you've got to make sure you don't step over in people's toes?
Mm-hmm. I like everything. I like everything. I really like writing my own stuff. Original work is very, very satisfying. I like working in a licensed universe, some more than others, but, you know, they all present interesting challenges and walls to bounce off that you wouldn't have, you know, when you're doing your own stuff. And I like shared worlds because Pangea, that, you know, the Kickstarter we just finished, is in its third volume, and that's a shared world, and we're bouncing off each other, and it's a little chaotic times, but it's a lot of fun. You know, writing is a solitary occupation in a lot of cases, and a shared world is a lot of fun. It's sort of like a role-playing game, you know. It's a lot like with other people whose company you enjoy. So, and the fact that we have some terrific writers working on it, it makes it just all that much more enjoyable. Wow. So, yeah. And the other thing I like about honchoing a shared world anthology and directing the Kickstarter is, you know, writers in this world, they need an audience and they need to get paid. And if I can do that for some other writer, that's worthwhile, you know, aside from whatever it brings to me in terms of opportunity to write or you know, remuneration, which in this case is not nearly proportionate to the effort I'm putting in. It's still worthwhile because I'm getting satisfaction from watching other great writers find an audience and pay their rent.
There you go.
Yeah. It's and that too, you know, the opportunity to give is an opportunity as well. You know, they say it's better to give than to receive. I don't know if it's better, but it's still very good.
Yes.
But by the same token, it can be a hell of a fun activity.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, the world, Thieves World and Wild Cards, that's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to contribute to something a little bigger than something you'd be doing on your own. But I also like, you know, writing collections of my short fiction. You know, it's funny. The internet has given us some opportunities that we didn't have before in the days when traditional publishing was the only way
king.
To go. King. I was going to say king, and then I changed it. It was the only way to go. It was the only option because they had the means of distribution and they had the means of production and no one else did. But in those days, the short stories, you know, would show up in magazines and so on, but a collection of short stories was, you know, what a publisher did for one of their best writers grudgingly. You know, all right, yeah, are you sure we really have to do this? All right, fine, you know, we'll get it out of the way, and then you can go on to those novels that are making us so much money.
Yeah.
But in the world of the internet, short stories are very, very much sought after. And you know, fiction doesn't have to fall into any particular length to be viable or commercial. So you can write a collection of short fiction and have people get interested in it. And you can also write participate in a shared world anthology and have people get interested in it.
Yeah. Well, life is so darn busy anymore, you know, that time is so limited. And if you can sit down and grab a short story over your lunch break, that's great. I love short story collections myself. I really enjoy them.
You know, I think the shorter fiction is the most appropriate for science fiction and also for fantasy, you know, particularly for science fiction, because a lot of it is in the idea, is in the concept. If you can present the concept in 30 pages, you really don't have to write 300, you know, because in a lot of ways, the concept is the hero. People are reading that story. So as long as you can develop a character or a story arc in 30 pages, that's probably the ideal length or close to the ideal length for science fiction.
Oh yeah, and you save a lot of time on world building, because when you say in space, everybody knows what that means.
One of the great things about writing comics is all you do is say we're out in space. It's a spaceship out there, and the artist draws it, and you don't have to say another thing. Yeah. That's one of the great things about writing comics is very little in the way of exposition.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if you have a great artist. You know, I've had some great ones. The guy I work with now, a Brazilian guy named Caio Cacau, you know, he sees where I'm going with something, and sometimes he's a step ahead of me. If you can get that, then you know you're in great shape.
Yeah, and his artwork is so clean and just really neat.
Yeah. And he's a great guy too. So I feel good about supporting him.
I think this gets right back to what you were saying, that you grew up with The Twilight Zone, and The Twilight Zone was a collection of short stories.
Yes, it really was. It really was. And, you know, I don't think I'd want to be in a world that had only short stories or no short stories, but it's certainly a big part of my background is something that you can see in half an hour and wrap up and move on to the next one. Something definitely something to be said for that, and it was visual. You know, Twilight Zone was very visual, and it was black and white, so you know, you really had some artistry that you don't often see on television these days. Well, a little more so recently. Mm-hmm. You do, but so they didn't have color to work with. It was black and white. A lot was done with light and shadow, and particularly when you know you were trying to achieve a mood in The Twilight Zone.
Well, it is sad that a lot of special effects stuff back then could be hidden by black and white that is in your face, bad in color.
Yeah. It's true. If it was bad, it was, color. I mean, saw something the other day. I can't remember what it was, but it was two versions of something, the original version with the shadows and so on. And then you saw the colored version and it kind of wiped out all the artistry.
But all those shadows have to go away because you have to have more lights to get the color.
I guess that's so. Jim, you know, I also teach and yes. I show Twilight Zones to my students, and while they have a antipathy for black and white productions, they do get into The Twilight Zone, and then you know, and then they ask me why it was done in black and white, and I say because you know the world was black and white back then, so mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, and we didn't have color TV then.
We didn't. I remember the first color television I ever saw. And you know, by the way, that Star Trek, the reason there is a Star Trek is because NBC was owned by a producer of color televisions.
And, yeah.
And they had to have color shows to go with the color capability.
We should probably think about wrapping this up. So,
or we'll talk all night.
Yeah, we could. And we've gone far astray, Kalis, but I don't think anybody minds. I certainly don't. So, Mike, other than Pangea 3, congratulations on getting that funded, by the way. Do you have any other projects in the fire that you'd like to talk about, if you can?
Sure. After that, one thing I'll be doing is another short story collection. I've written a few of the stories already, and they do have that quality of little twists at the end that you mentioned.
All right.
So doing another one of those, and I'm also doing a full-length novel set in an alternate reality 21st century Aztec Empire. The character is Mashla Kalua. He's essentially a gumshoe. He's an investigator for the empire. And this is a 21st century Aztec empire that stretches from the tip of North America to the tip of South America. And in this world, Cortez never conquered the Aztecs. And so they became the dominant culture in North and South America. And it's kind of an isolationist culture. So all the mysteries that take place there are kind of contained in this, in what seems to us like an alien culture.
Okay, yeah. Just take my money. I'm looking forward to reading more about Max.
So up until now, I've written a couple of novellas and a couple of short stories, and this will be the first full length novel for him.
That'll be great. He's an ex-jock turned detective. And
right.
he gets some help along the way from some real experienced people, but he always gets his man, as they say.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. I love him as a character. I thoroughly enjoy writing him, and you know, there's a case where you really have to these are walls I've created, but you really have to stay within these walls. And not violate the premises that you set down.
Yeah.
They always say that if you're writing a book that includes magic, it's got more rules than real science does, because you've got to have a hard, fast Bible that you've got to stick to, or the magic is not. Doesn't have any verisimilitude.
Right. True. Mm. You have to, just like if you were writing a book about 21st century America, you'd have to have your details right. And in magic, it's even more important, because these are unfamiliar things, and the reader has to know what can be done and what can't be done.
So my question becomes, if this guy is an ex-jock, what was his sport?
He was a star in the Aztec ball court.
Okay.
Is it, you're familiar with that?
You didn't steal a modern sport. You stuck with an Aztec sport.
Yeah.
Right.
And it is brutal.
Oh yeah.
It's brutal. It's not as brutal as it was in the days of the Aztecs, where depending on what time you were talking about, they sacrificed either the winners or the losers, but that doesn't happen. But it's very much the dominant sport in their culture, and he was a star of the ball court until he sustained an injury that made it impossible for him to go on.
But what's important is you've done the research into Aztec culture, and you're keeping the characters Aztecian.
Yes. Yeah. They're very much that. They're very very much that. But it's the modern Aztec culture. They're not worshiping the gods in most cases the way they did. It's a little more cynical. But the gods pervade their civilization anyway. You'll see them on cereal boxes and billboards and things like that. Very much a part of their culture.
Yeah, it's a neat world to read about. So, well, as I said, we're gonna go ahead and wrap this up. Mike, thank you for being generous with your time and talking with us for such a long time. That's really neat. I think our listeners will enjoy this. Mike Friedman is a New York City-born author of over 75 books of fiction and nonfiction, more than half of which are in the licensed tie-in products of the Star Trek franchise. And he has had a number of those on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yep.
So
11 of them have made the list, the primary list. So I'm very grateful for that, and thanks. It's always good talking to you, Jim, and John. It was great talking to you as well. And
I appreciate you guys, your insights.
Yes,
my pleasure. And call me anytime.
I was just going to say, can we have you back in the future?
Absolutely. Excellent. Absolutely.
All right. Well, for Bond by Honor, I am Ja Jim.
I am Jorn. And we'd like to thank our guest, Michael Jan Friedman, for a very interesting conversation.
Yes.
Kapla, boys.
Thank you. Kapla.
Kapla.
Well, that was a great interview with Mike Friedman, the author of Kalis. And I just thought, John, you and I could, I thought we could hang around a little after Mike signs off and we could visit about this book a little bit.
Okay, well, here we are. This is not the first book about on this podcast now that has had intermittent chapters of this type.
No, we've had a couple. You remember the titles of those?
The one I'm thinking in particular is The Romulan Way.
Yeah, that bounced back and forth between history and modern times. Well, at least in the timeline that it was written.
And with that book, you could tell that a different writer was writing each chapter. Whereas with Kalis, you can tell that it's the same writer writing each chapter.
Yes, that's for sure. So what were your overall impressions of this book?
Overall, I thought the historical Kalis story was fascinating, was something to follow, and something to, in your own right, to piece together the legends of Kalis with what was the actual historical record, as Mike put down.
So as I'm thinking about this book again, the legendary, the heroic era material in every other chapter was from the scrolls that were found?
That is correct.
Okay, so, as far as my overall impression of the book was, is I thought it was absolutely fascinating to take a look back and see Kalis in the light that Mike painted him. However, in this day and age when we have so few heroes left, it also made me sad at the same time to learn the things that I learned. And if this were actually canon, I think I would be very disappointed.
I was a little disappointed in the story that went on in modern times with Picard, Worf, and Kalis. I would rather have seen the clerics of the Klingon Empire discussing the ramifications of the scrolls that were found. But I can understand what Mike is saying, is that the mainstream reader is going to want to see a story that's going to involve characters that they know, not a bunch of clerics that they don't.
Yeah. And let's face it, a clerical discussion would not have attracted readers. I mean, that's just not something they're looking for. You know, they're not looking for a story that'll make them think. They're looking for a story with some action and conflict and so forth and so on. And of course, yes, bringing the Enterprise crew in, Picard, Worf, and then eventually bringing Kern into the picture also made them quite a force for action. And there was plenty of action in the modern era parts of the story.
See, I'm looking at it from a CAG perspective here. And there's a lot of members of CAG that I think would be more interested in a theological discussion of what the scrolls mean and how they can use that kind of information in crafting their personas and generating activities at conventions or whatever events they want to do.
I can definitely see that angle, and I agree with it. There would be a lot of interest in CAG itself, but let's face it, how
CAG is not enough to pay for the book.
Right. How many CAG members will buy the book to begin with, and will there be enough to pay for it? Especially since it was produced by, I think Mike said, Paramount.
Well, at that time, Paramount owned Star Trek. CBS since has bought Paramount.
Yeah. So, you know, you want to attract as wide an audience as possible. And, you know, emblazoned on the cover is Star Trek Next Generation, which at that time would have sold more copies than just marketing to CAG.
That's correct. But that does not stop you, the listeners, from taking what Michael has written as the history of Kalis based on these scrolls and integrating that into some sort of talk, presentation, or event activity at a convention or event that you're going to be at. Use this information, integrate it into what you do, integrate it into your persona, live it.
Well, that would be one angle to approach. But then again, do we want to nerf Kalis, where we have this picture of a super Klingon warrior who absolutely took the Empire by storm, changed everything philosophically, and turned it all around and made it something that was honorable, where, of course, Molor had absolutely, apparently, no sense of honor whatsoever.
So I guess the problem here is I'm channeling the book from last time, The Klingon Art of War, which is a book that's beautifully written for people to take apart and use whatever activity they're going, even if it comes down to preaching the word of Kalis. I think this falls into another extension of that very activity.
Yeah. And absolutely, I have already begun working on a panel based on Keith's book.
Well, my suggestion, Jim, would be when you get your notes pulled together, see if you can find a place to upload them, whether it's on the Clerics of the Empire CAG site or even just on the podcast down below, and let people take a look at them and see how that type of activity could be done.
Yeah, I do intend to share it around, because I seriously think that a lot of people would be able to do good presentations at conventions with the material from that book, provided I put it together well.
And remember, we're not going to put any spoilers out there, because this book was written 23 years ago.
Well, I don't have a problem spoiling a 23-year-old book.
Pretty hard to do.
So, I think you mentioned your favorite point of plot already.
Yeah, I was not thrilled with the modern day stuff. I thought it was just a touch on the lame side for next generation writers. But the historical side kept me going.
I would have to agree with that to a point. I have to agree more, because as I think back on reading the book, I remember and retain a lot more of the historical story than I do the modern story.
The modern story just slipped on by. The historical side stuck with you. But what I may have, my problem may be that Michael had written this book towards the end of the early era of Star Trek writers. And that particular modern story probably fell well within that type of style of story that was being written. We've reviewed a few books lately that are more modern. They have more detail and, to my mind, are a little bit more interesting than some of the older books.
Good point. Yeah, the writing style, I guess, would change over the years. I can't really speak to it that much because, other than the books that we've read lately, there was a long gap of many years where I never even picked up a Star Trek book.
So what were your favorite themes or plot points?
Okay, well, of course, as I said, in the historic age, I guess the overall picture that we got of Kalis as the unlikely hero of the story, where he wasn't actively seeking what he wound up being, but it was thrust upon him, and he actually came across almost more as a figurehead than anything else, and how all this stemmed from his refusal to collect taxes and destroy a village that couldn't afford to pay any tribute. And he just finally put his foot down and said, this is enough. I mean, we cannot do this. It's not honorable. And so I think, you know, we see the dawn of Kalis's honor at this point. And that's what really sent this story moving, was that sense of honor and not violating one's personal honor, even if their life would become endangered by it.
And then what about all the areas of myth that Michael turned on its head in this book, like the fight between Morath, who is Kalis's brother in myth, but Kalis's lieutenant in this story, that the fight was literally 180 degrees different. Kalis was not tracking down his brother to get his brother to be honorable, but Morath was tracking down Kalis to get Kalis to act in his honorable instincts.
Yeah, that was, you know, as I read, it was like, no, that's not the way it is. No, that's not the way it is. That's not the way Worf tells the stories. That's not the mythology that we get through Next Generation. And, you know, I'll tell you what, it takes a lot of guts to write the story the way Mike did, and stand by it like he did, because, you know, that could cause a whole lot of problems if it didn't work out right.
And then there was the legend of the Lady Lucara. What it turned out to be in the scrolls was radically different, not just the name change, but the story and the history were radically different than what you see in, say, the Pakbak, which is the story of King.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the legends are definitely different than what we're used to. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's a good thing, that things get shook up a little bit and give us something to think about, because it sure made me think, especially, you know, these scrolls show up telling the truth that Kalis isn't as big as he is.
And to an extent, doesn't that make the Kalis figure a more believable figure?
Yes, it does. It does. And on the other hand, it kind of blows things up. You know what I mean? It tears things down. You lose your heroes. I've experienced this numerous times in my lifetime where someone is hero to me. Well, for instance, the original seven astronauts. In my mind, as I recall looking, watching them on TV when I was a kid, you know, 6, 7 years old, these guys were amazing people, and they were heroes, and they were Boy Scouts, and they never did anything wrong, and all this stuff. And then you read Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff, and you find out that, you know, they were just regular guys, and they had faults and things like that. They made mistakes, and it just kind of hurts when your heroes die. You know what I mean?
But they made mistakes. They weren't total Boy Scouts, but they still went ahead and did some really miraculous things. Kalis was not the figure that we were told about. He had his foibles. He had his fears. He had his challenges. But he still led his armies against Moar in the end and did the very heroic deeds.
Well, and then if you also think about it, it is Klingon nature to embellish a story. So after 1,500 years of telling these stories over and over and over again, you could see how they would evolve into the legends that they did become.
And Klingons are very good storytellers.
And good embellishers.
I thought I said that.
Oh, yeah. Same thing.
Isn't that the nature of a storyteller?
Yeah, it can be. It just depends on what story you're telling and the message you want the audience to get.
So I think we're both saying that essentially this is a book people should read.
Absolutely. I think the publication date is 1996. So we're talking about a 23-year-old book here. And yes, I think that it should be read by members of our of CAG, at least, in order to give them another angle to discuss at panels, at conventions, and so forth and so on.
By the way, Jim, the book was reprinted in a anthology of The Final Reflection and Kalis in what's called The Hand of Kalis in 2004.
Ah, so there is a more modern version of it that a person could pick up. You know, it's funny how
being
I got
the same book, though.
Yeah, it's funny how I picked up my copy of Kalis, and it's just kind of a silly little story. One of my students, and this is one of the kids that I taught when I first started at my current posting 20 years ago, found out I was a Star Trek fan, and so was he, and he brought me this book, this particular book. And I took it home, I read about half of it, and things got busy, and I couldn't finish, and I set it aside on a shelf. And then that young man graduated, and I said, oh, you know, I got to get you that book back. He says, don't worry about it. He said, you just keep it. He says, I read it, and maybe you'll get to it someday. And so I just picked it up here, a week and a half ago, and started reading it again. It's been sitting there for all this time. And so mine is a paper and ink copy, hardback, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I had a paperback version of it. I can't find that. I happen to have The Hand of Kalis, so I could read it in that printing.
Ah, and now I've got all those books, either on my Kindle or the hardback copy.
Yeah, I'm afraid to say I'm still a fan of paper because, well, it's tough to get an author to sign a Kindle.
Yes, that's very true. As a matter of fact, like Mike's books, I've got several of his books around here that I helped back on Kickstarter. And so the nice part about it is when you back Mike on Kickstarter at a reasonable level, he will send you an electronic copy, and then he will send you an autographed trade paperback also. So I've got a lot of his books that way. So, but yeah, absolutely. If you meet the author, you definitely want to get a copy. A lot of the books that I have that have been signed, I've got sealed. I use the food sealer upstairs to seal the books away so they don't deteriorate.
Again, that's going to depend too on the type of paper and the type of ink that they use at the time of printing. But we've talked about Kickstarter in the interview, and you're talking about Kickstarter now. Maybe you ought to explain to listeners what Mike is doing with Kickstarter.
Okay. What he has done is through Crazy 8 Press, the authors, him, and several others got together and put their own deal together. But to produce a book costs money. It costs money for paper. It costs money for ink. It costs money for the printing and all those things. So
the artwork, the setup, the editing, there's a lot more than just the physical costs of the paper and stuff that go into a book.
Right. And so what Mike does is he writes stories that probably would not be picked up by a mainstream publishing house and decides to publish them himself. And he starts out by starting a Kickstarter campaign where he'll do a clever video and ask for donations in return for copies of the book, electronic copies, hard copies, and just a whole bunch of different perks that he'll offer. And when you reach the goal, it's funded. So as you contribute to this process, it doesn't cost you anything unless the project is fully funded. Then your money comes out of your account and goes to Mike, where he uses that to produce the book. The one we were discussing yesterday, the new one, the Pangea, is going to be an anthology of short stories from several authors, and I don't have the list in front of me right now, but I believe Keith DeCanado is one, and if I'm not mistaken, I hope I don't shoot myself in the foot with this, but I think Dayton Ward is also contributing to this collection of stories. So, you know, Mike went to call for funding. He got funding, and now it's time to go to work and put the book together. Here in about, I'd think about probably 4 or 5 months, everything will be done, put together, and I will receive a email with an electronic copy.
You mentioned an electronic copy and a physical copy. What other perks? Because I know both Kickstarters, the more you contribute, the more perks you get. What other perks does he offer?
Well, for certain levels, there are more and more. And then, of course, you get everything that was offered before at the lower levels as you grow. So there, he'll have a copy of the cover that he'll autograph, or is one possible deal. Another one is the level that I went at. My name is going to show up in one of the stories somewhere. You can also contribute at another level where you are actually like a walk-on character in one of the stories. And then there's extended bonuses where you might get other books that they've written as a bonus. So yeah, it just grows and grows and grows.
Now he's not gonna pull a David Weber on you, is he? David Weber auctions off the right to have a glorious death in his Honor Harrington novels.
Well, I'll tell you what. In the other book that we talked about, Headless, that short story collection, I contributed at a level where I was in one of the stories, not me physically, but my name was mentioned, and I had a house with a nice yard and a dog sitting out front. So, you know, I guess it all depends. No, I didn't get killed off, and I don't know if I would or not, because I didn't contribute at that level to where I'm a physical character. I will get a mention somewhere.
And that used to be called Tuckerization.
I think it still is, but...
You know where that comes from, right?
You know, I actually don't.
The author, Wilson Bob Tucker, would occasionally drop his friends' names into his novels. It happened so often that it got to be called Tuckerization.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, with my little writings for the writing group I'm involved with, I Tuckerize a lot. So, yeah.
It's the easiest way to come up with names.
Yeah. Well, we should probably close this out, John. We've been running
considering about, the fact that we're farbling on other topics.
You know, that's true. We've gone astray. My closing thoughts on Kalis. I think it is a really good book. Overall speaking, the historical story is more compelling than the modern era story. But there's still a lot in the modern era story that's interesting, but it is definitely supported by the heroic Kalis story, where we find out that Kalis is not as heroic as we would be led to believe, at least in the universe as created by Mike Friedman.
And my final thoughts are to again appeal to everyone to get a copy of the book, read the book, digest the book, and see how you can use the information that has come from this book to spice up your Klingon experience.
Sounds like a great idea. So next time on Bound by Honor, we are going to be reading Star Trek, the original series, an Excelsior book called Forged in Fire by Michael A. Martin and Andy Mangels.
And while it's kind of listed in the original series, it actually takes place between Star Trek V and Star Trek VI, as Sulu is becoming the captain of the Excelsior.
Yes, and we get a whole lot of stuff here in this book. It's 500 pages. We get the albino from Deep Space Nine. We get Kang, Kor, and Koloth together, along with Curzon Dax, who made the original Blood Oath with those three Klingons. So, you know, this is going...
And this is Curzon before he's made his mark on the Klingon Empire. It's, you get to see him making that mark.
Yeah, this is going to be... I think it's going to be a really good book. I'm really looking forward to it.
And I think we should probably stop talking about it. Otherwise, we're going to end up doing the review now.
Well, since that'd be kind of difficult since I haven't read it. Now, you've read it, so you could spoil it quite a bit. But at any rate, we're going to sign off for now. I'm Judge Jim.
I am Jorn.
And join us next time on Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast.
Kapla!
Kapla! You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!